on the Fear Nova podcast, episode 110. We have Sebastian Chow. What's going on?
Hey, guys. How are you?
Doing good.
The last time you were on our podcast was actually our 100th episode. First, I thought it was the virtual Comic-Con, and then I went on your Facebook real quick, and I was like, oh, you were on that.
Very brief appearance.
You are the creator of Catapulted. Is that still going on?
It is still going on. It's probably going on a little bit too long, but Catapulted. I think launched in 2017, just with one issue, and I'd like to tie it up as just a complete mini series. So I'm working on finishing that at the moment, and the next Kickstarter hopefully will be to just wrap that up as a complete trade paperback that people can have. And I've just finished some work for Blue Fox Comics, which is a company here in the UK. There's a writer, Simon Burke. He's written lots of he's done anthologies, and he's done lots of miniseries. And I illustrated the first issue of the second volume of Gone, which is a sci-fi story. And he did a Kickstarter for that. It must be about a month ago that was successfully funded. Received back the digital edition, so I could see the colors and the lettering that was applied, and it's all looking great. So there'll be a couple more issues of that coming soon as well that I'll be working on this year.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I didn't know that was even on Kickstarter until I went on your Facebook, and I was like, I didn't even know this thing was on there. So
he'd done a really short campaign. I think it was like 9 days long. I think he was trying to experiment and see what kind of results he could get. Considering it was 9 days and there wasn't too much heavy promotion on it, it seemed to do quite well.
231 backers. Yeah. 3,923 pounds. Yeah, that's a pretty big 9-day Kickstarter.
he's built a great audience, because he's done so many Kickstarters over the years. And you look at some of his other ones, and they're going to the tens of thousands and loads of people, lots of backers. He's a very talented writer. I think you'll be seeing, I think he's striking up some work with some mainstream publishers. So I think you'll be seeing his name a bit more. He churns them out. He's really good. Nice guy as well. So.
Cool. And you said you did the coloring for this?
No. So actually, all the images you're seeing at the moment, they're all from the first volume, which I've had nothing to do with. So none of that art is mine. But I've done all the pencils and the inks for the next volume. So yeah, that cover. That's Simon there. That you'll see that. So yeah, there's none of the sequentials are shown in the campaign. So hopefully it'll be a bit of a surprise for the backers.
Nice. That's actually a cool idea to show off a lot of the old stuff to show what the new one's going to look like.
Yeah, cool. See if I can grab a. Let me see if I can grab a quick preview of a few pages to share. Should have this straight to hand. It continues from the first volume. It's just a nice mystery sci-fi comic. It's what intrigued me. All ages comic, which is something I'm kind of big on. Let's see if I can share this. Okay, so I want two page, and I want that. And let's share screen. Okay, here we go. This cover was done by Lyndon White. Who's another artist. He also did the colors. And this is the next issue. So a bit of a different art style to the first one. I'm kind of quite big on details and lots of contrast, which we'll talk about in a bit. It's about this robot that's trying to figure out what's happened to him. In his mind, he's a human. He wakes up and realizes he's in a robot's body, and he's accompanied by a friend of his, who's another robot, but actually seems to be a projection of his mind. And he's kind of trying to help him piece together what's happened to him and how he's ended up.
That's very cool.
So, yeah.
So, a sci-fi psychological thriller.
Yeah. So if people are interested, if you go to, I think it's Blue Fox Comics website, it'll probably be available on there at some point. There'll be another Kickstarter later in the year if you follow Simon. We'll wrap that up as a trade.
Awesome. So today we're not going to be talking about K-Stars really. We'll probably go back onto that or whatever. But if the mood strikes, you're going to be actually educating people on, you know, creating and all that stuff, because a lot of our episodes have not been educational lately. It would be good to go back into that. And
perfect cool. person to do that. So. Yeah, I love the whole comics theory, you know, I revel in it. I love it. I'm a big fan of Scott McCloud, he really delves into comics theory in like a level that, you know, still fills me with awe. And I'm constantly going back to his books and finding new stuff. Hopefully some of the stuff we'll talk about will be useful. There's sometimes that a lot of them are questions that I see in forums, in either Facebook groups or art groups, and they're like, you know, how do I approach this, or you know, how do you know how to do certain things? And there is, from what I found and read, you know, there is logic and a reason to doing certain things and making certain choices. And it, you know, it can all help service the story that people are trying to create.
So. Cool. Yeah. And I'm still learning as we're going anyway. Like, I'm not a letterer, so I don't know all of those rules. I should probably learn that, though. If you're not a letterer, you should probably learn those rules, just so you know what's going on. Because friend Hector, that's helping with editing a bunch of our comics, he's like, Dylan use a lot of ellipses. I was like, oh, okay. And he's like, yeah, like, you don't use ellipses. And I was like, oh, well, I just read like two comics that have ellipses. And then he's like, oh, well, I use the double dash thing. It's like, oh, well, yeah.
Yeah.
Just use whatever you want to use. But he, I guess, doesn't really like the ellipses because it doesn't flow as well. And I was like, oh, I don't know. I still pause in my head when I'm reading something like that.
there's always exceptions. There's a great book by Nate Picos, I think his name is. Letterer. He's done a bunch of Image comics and Marvel and DC, I believe. And he brought a book out recently, How to Letter Comics. Great resource. He's had a blog for a long time. Blambot Lettering. He creates his own fonts. He's been very generous with sharing all the knowledge on lettering. And he goes through those kind of things, like the rules that are kind of in lettering comics. And you can always break those rules, but again, he gives reasons as to why you'd letter a certain way. But yeah, great, great resource. And he provides some great fonts as well, if you're after some fonts for your comic.
Yeah, I think we use that site for whatever the font that we used when I think Dylan lettered our first comic.
Yeah, the basic back issue, and forgot the other one it's called. They're like the one of them is like the original comic book font. I think that's the one that's called like back issue BB, something like that. And then there's the other one for like the explosives, like when it's like kablow or whatever, right? Then it would be in this other font that I don't remember that name. But it was fun. I found a couple of those.
Nice. So should I just dive in? Or?
Yeah, just dive in.
Okay, so the first topic I thought to talk about, there's going to be a mixture of things that are good for artists and things that are good for writers, and then kind of a subject that kind of ties in both. So for the kind of art side, I wanted to talk about, I suppose it's something that I wish was, I saw more in art, in comics. And I think it's a really good tool for artists. It allows you to do different things with a page, and that is contrast. So what I mean by contrast is it's really, I suppose it's the difference between light and dark. So, and the way you really use contrast in comics is you hear the term spotting blacks, you know, and you're looking for where you can add, you know, complete black to the page. And from an artistic point of view, you tend to think, okay, well, I'm adding in contrast, you know, where can I add in the, you know, lots of difference between light and dark and on the page. And you tend to think from a anatomical, artistic point of view, okay, where's the light source? Okay, if the light is here, then these are going to be in shadow, which is fine. And obviously you need to kind of follow those rules. But in comics, you can kind of break those rules a little bit, because you're not just using contrast to depict where is the light source. Like, to me, that's the most basic level. You can add blacks, spot blacks, to add weight. You're trying to maybe emphasize mass and dimension, mood. You know, if you're doing a noir comic, then, you know, more often than not, you're going to use quite a bit of black to create that mood. Even when sometimes, okay, the shadows wouldn't quite work like that in real life. And you can do more of it. So you can frame certain elements of the story, or you can direct the reader's eye very cleverly by using, you know, big chunks of black on the page or in panels. And all of that now starts to add to the story, because you're not just using it just to show where light sources are. Now you're using it, you can use black to anchor the eye. And, you know, if you're an artist and you're creating a page, you know, okay, you want the eye to flow a certain way across the page. Typically, most people think of like a Z pattern, you know, you're kind of going left to right, you're working your way down the page. And you can use contrast to help do that, because your eyes work primarily on contrast. So before you look at color, your eye will focus on the point of highest contrast first. And we do this without even thinking. And so if you plan your page a certain way, you can direct the flow of the eye by using the points of highest contrast. And you can do that from panel to panel. And I tried to, there was an example that was in a book a while back, and I tried to find it, because there was this page and you looked at it and it just kind of asked you, okay, you know, in each panel, where does your eye immediately go to? And then it created it kind of drew the lines of along the points of contrast, and it was following this kind of Z pattern. It was very clever in, you know, in doing that. And those are things that I think are at the disposal of artists to kind of, you know, that's your storytelling tools. That's part of your storytelling tools. So it's no longer just, okay, I'm drawing an image or in a panel and I want to depict the light source. It's now, how can I use this overall composition of the page to help, you know, now move the eye across the page? And I don't know when you're writing, or I don't know, when you consider your favorite artists, do they tend to use contrast when you think of the artists that you like?
Probably not as much as, so a lot of the storytelling that we do, we try to make it so that the panels themselves draw you across. So like we do that in the writing, but obviously like we're not the artist. So I don't know if I've ever actually looked for an artist's work to see if they did that, because without knowing the writing behind it, I wouldn't know if they matched it. But that's a pretty interesting thing. I was actually going to ask too, I think I've seen, was it contrast also used for depth, right? That's another thing you can do, right? Like with like different levels of darkness to show that it's further away or closer up, depending on how you want to look at the scene.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Depth and dimension. So I'll share a little, I hope this works. Okay. So here's okay, I think I'm getting better at this. Okay, so this is from Wizard. Oh, I used to love the Wizard magazine. They used to do basic training articles, and they did a collection in a collection of all of those articles and published it as I think there was a few different books. There was one big one that was really useful. And so this is taken from there. And just like you said, Dylan, this is there we go. These first two images, E and F, is doing just that. So you can use contrast to help separate the background and foreground elements.
Yeah, we're like typically like the furthest thing up or the furthest thing back is like extremely black. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. And it just looks, you look at the two images, you know, most people will be drawn to figure F just because there's that high contrast, and the image is more, usually the more high contrast the image, the more visually appealing it is. So that's an example of separating background and foreground, like you said. Now, here's a good one, figure A and B here. And I don't know, you tell me, in figure A, where is your eye drawn to, or where does it settle, I should say? And in figure B, where does your eye settle? This would be an interesting test. This could just decimate my
thing. Greg, you go first.
Oh, and B, I noticed the window first. And A, I noticed the gun. I don't know why. Yes. So.
Hey, so I'm not talking nonsense then. So that's exactly what they were trying to illustrate. So in A, obviously, you know, the gun's the point of interest. It's probably part of the story. It looks like she's found it or whatever. But in B, your eye is drawn to a background element. You know, maybe it could be part of the story, actually. Maybe there'll be a poster there or something that might be of interest. But you can see how contrast, depending where you put the contrast, your eye will focus and settle on that element the most.
It's interesting, too. Like, the other thing it looks like they did on this was, like, even in figure B, the gun's drawn in great detail, but the window's very basic. So you might get first drawn to the window, but you'll still, like, inevitably see the gun. And maybe that window in the background is, like, yeah, a poster that's, you know, trying to draw our attention, like, oh, something's behind her, and we didn't notice because we're so focused on the foreground.
Yeah. Yeah. So, it can be used in that way, you know, to really highlight different elements of the panel, you know, and you can use, artists can use that to their advantage. Sometimes, you know, a writer might say, you know, to emphasize a certain part of a panel. And there's different ways to do that. You know, you can frame it compositionally and, you know, you zoom in and focus, and that's fine. That's one way to do it. But contrast is also another way. It's just got so many uses. And I do feel sometimes it's a little bit underutilized from artists. It is something that takes a while to kind of get your brain thinking that way. But I think it's really effective. And actually, when I think of all my favorite artists, you know, guys like Sean Gordon Murphy, Travis Charé, I'm a big fan of, even Adam Hughes, even, you know, ones like Jim Lee. You look at their art and there's big areas of black in their work, and you'll see them use it quite, you know, and it works from you're trying to depict light and dark, but I find my eyes naturally drawn to work that's got high contrast. In it, you know, when you think of like sequential original art, like you know you can buy the original pages, the ones that have got like high contrast, they're just like amazing to look at because they just look fantastic.
I was gonna say, I feel like that's really when you had what's it called, inkers as like a separate art. Like, it's something where, like, a lot of the comic book illustrators now are both pencilers and inkers, but like that was a separate job. And so you'd have somebody that would sketch this whole thing up, and then the inkers would go through with a very fine pen and draw exactly where the shadows and the dark had to be before it got to the colorist. And so it is a very interesting, because I've always also wondered that, why the inkers went before the colorists.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, I think that's why, is because the colorist can obviously make it pop with color, But I think that I would be willing to bet that the like the black and white contrast or even a bright color and then full black is a much better drawer of the story. Like it pulls you across than any of the colors will. Unless, you know, again, you're doing something crazy, you know, holographic paint looking stuff. Yeah.
This is actually, I'm going to show something in a second. This is like one of my favorite pages from any of our comics so far. One of my favorite pages. I have other favorite pages in other comics, but this is one of my favorite, just how it's all laid out and the color and all that stuff.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is one of my favorites too.
Him turning into like superhuman.
And it's cool too, because this one has a very big Z. Like it's not a Z across a tight panel. It goes from top left to right all the way. It cuts right down to that guy in the bottom left with the glowing eyes and then goes across to the, you know, the blasting of the eyes.
Yeah. You've got a bit of everything there. There's a nice silhouette at the end. And yeah. it really draws in your eye and draws in the reader, and you kind of feel more into the panel. So
yeah. I think the other thing too with like panels like that is just the fact that when there is that much contrast, because your eye goes like that, like you notice the silhouette at the end, but you're, you know, an artist looking at that going, oh, look at that's clever. But some people, they'll go back and forth three times looking at all those panels, and then they'll go, oh, I didn't even see the little guy in the corner. He's like just the silhouette, like he's walking away. Like that's cool. And I really like the idea that it's almost like a splash page, but it's not. There is a linear story there, and the whole idea is that by having all this wow color, like that particular scene is a nightmare scene. That's what we call it. It's like this moment where he's envisioning something that will soon to come to him, and like it's like this idea that it is chaotic, and that's why that Z pattern is so large, and then it ends with this little silhouette that you don't notice until probably the second or third scan through.
Yeah. Yeah, it's clever, and there's some really good resources on how you can use contrast for composition and mood, and just to share an excerpt of something that I found really useful. It's a book by Marcos Mateo Mesta. I'm probably pronouncing that horribly. I've got a thing at the end with it to show you what book this is, but basically this is a snapshot of how he breaks down contrast, so the light and the dark, as well as just the composition of the lines on the page, and how that affects the reader. So these are just four examples of, and he's got many examples in his book. He's got two books on this. One's Framed Ink, Volume 1, and Framed Ink, Volume 2. I highly recommend them. I'm still going back and studying them. But you'll see he kind of breaks down, okay, what are the shapes that the contrast creates, and how does that become perceived? So,
Marcos Mateo Mestre, is that the name? I was trying to look him up. Marcos Mateo Mestre.
Very talented. And you'll see in all of his work, he uses a high amount of contrast, even in his example. So, for example, in this frame, it's kind of mostly black, a little highlighted area. That kind of composition and the positioning of the dark and the light areas, he says it kind of makes the image appear more unnatural. Therefore, you're including a sense of unpredictability in that panel. And you're like, oh, wow, okay, so now... You know, because I would struggle to think how I would have captured that kind of that feeling, if that's what you're trying to create. And he does it for other things as well. This is probably a good example of the one we saw before, where the framing, it frames the badge, so your eyes kind of drawn there, and it's from the point of view of the other person.
It's interesting because, like in this one, what he's doing is the opposite, where everything's black and then the stuff he wants you to focus on is white. And with this, when you're doing lettering over the top of it, there's plenty of space to work with too, because everything's been shadowed out.
Yeah. Yeah. So he looks at it from two points of view, from a contrast and then like a kind of directional line point of view, and kind of how do those two elements then create a certain feeling for the reader. So again, lots of contrast in his book, and some really good examples to study. So yeah, I find that particularly helpful.
Like putting all these books down, because like the only book I have for like comic book illustration is like the basic How to Draw the Marvel Way, you know, just getting, like, getting that type of general idea of how to put together a comic, where these are like much more detailed.
Yeah, there's some, I seem to be a collector of these kind of things. When one comes out, I'm like, I've got to grab it. And so I've got books on how to letter, on how to color, how to pencil the DC way, the Marvel way, how to color the DC way, panel discussions. Most of my shelves are like full of those kind of books. So
that's excellent.
Cool. So hopefully that's been a bit of interest to artists who might be listening. The second subject I kind of wanted to delve into was panel layout. I see this often in Facebook groups. How do I decide to lay out the page? Excuse me. If the writer's kind of giving me hasn't given me direction on, okay, I want a full page width, two-thirds panel with this particular view. You know, some writers like to
we're those writers that are like, I noticed that because I've seen some other people's like scripts before, and because I think I mentioned before, like the reason why we haven't focused too much on like finding the anchor that matches our storytelling is like we're very much like two-thirds top panel, panoramic, long shot, close up, mid shot, like we're like But it's interesting because we do every once in a while leave a panel open and we're like, I'm curious what the artist will do. So that's very cool.
Cool. Interesting. And is that the same for you, Greg, as well? Like quite tight on the script?
When I'm writing it, I don't put any angles. It is very limited if I actually do that, just because Dylan either edits that and then he puts those in. It becomes Mr. Director, or when Hector is editing, he is an artist. So, like, mostly he's an artist. So he's like, oh, well, this is going to be the angle that would work for this. So, yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, that's why I like it. I was going to say, if the artist has a better idea on something, I don't mind it. But very often, I don't write them. I just edit Greg's, essentially. And I'll see, like, what he's trying to do, and I'm like, oh, well, then you want to be focused on this. So we need to be like over the shoulder of this guy looking at that person so we can see both of them. This is the frame, right? And just knowing that this is how the story should move along. I always try to like make sure like, okay, this panel should be bigger to emphasize it more than the other one, like little details like that. So yeah, I like storytelling, but definitely not on the, I'm like, hopefully the artist knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah. And it can be, and this is where this collaboration part comes in, you've got that, you kind of need both sides, and sometimes if you're writing doing a comic yourself or it's left completely open, it can be a bit daunting, like how do I decide which panel should be bigger or smaller, or how they should be laid out. And I think you hit the nail on the head. It's kind of what you want to focus on, and generally the bigger the panel, the more someone will focus on it because there's more to look at and it's kind of dominating the page.
I was going to say, I think the other thing too is like, I noticed that we do more panel, like description of the panel itself in the beginning of the comic and less at the end. And I think the reason for that too is, so the first comic we ever had drawn up, which has gone to the incinerator, basically the idea was we just told the story, and the way it was drawn, there was like not enough room for lettering. There wasn't enough room for the story to really be there. It wasn't broken down into panels, right? So it was just mostly written out. And so like, I think this is for page one. And then the panels would lay out in a way that you couldn't tell the whole story. So there's gaps missing. And actually, coincidentally, one of our fan favorite comics, Ink, was partially drawn like that because I didn't edit it before it went out. So we actually ended up rewriting all of the script while keeping the artwork. So we actually we went back through and we're like, you know what? Let's change this from a dialogue to an internal narration. And now the panels can flow a little smoother. We don't need these like internal or in between frames that are just completely missing because we didn't spell it out for the artist. And so, but with our newest stuff, which I think is going really like way better, I think having it more detailed in the beginning so that the artist fully understands the story we're telling helps them figure out, okay, now that I know where you're going, these other panels, this is actually what you should do. This looks way better. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's key, and that's the advice I'd give to artists is exactly that. You have to understand the story, and when you're understanding the story and the either the emotions or the feeling that the writer is trying to go for, now you're better equipped to decide which how do I lay out the pages or the panels on a page. And maybe you start to then look at the script and you say, okay, well, out of this page, this is probably the most important panel for this particular page. You know, I can see the writers building up to this particular moment, or it might be over a couple of pages. But generally, you kind of want to, as an artist, understand, okay, where's the punchline, or where's that that moment that the writer's building to? And then you can work from that, because then you can decide, okay, if that's the key moment of this scene or this page, then, okay, maybe that's where I want the reader to look the most, or that's where I want the impact to be. So maybe that's your main panel, perhaps, or, you know, and then you can, now you've got something to guide you in laying out your panels, because now you're doing it with purpose. You're like, okay, I'm doing it to hit this point in the story, rather than, okay, do I just grab a random panel and I do it this size and, you know, okay, maybe I could draw it from this angle. So like you said, I think once an artist gets into the story and can sense the story beats and what you're going for, it becomes a lot easier to lay out your page.
Yeah, that should make me think of two things. The first one is, like, if an artist is working with a writer who's not that experienced, and they get into the writer's head and they now know what the panels are going to be laid out. Something that, you know, we try to focus on a lot now is every time, like, you're going across the story, like the bottom right panel should always be like a curiosity panel so that you want to flip. And then that first thing always needs to be like, whoa, I want to keep going. And like, hey, you know, I think that, like, if you want to be like a really good artist for somebody who's like an okay writer, like being able to help out with that type of stuff, I think would be amazing. And then the other thing I was thinking, what was the other thing I was thinking? I was going to ask, actually, when you mentioned like there's the focus panel, like the thing that's most important. As an artist, do you draw that panel first?
Sometimes. Sometimes I will, if there's a real key moment. So sometimes I'll lay out and I can... Because I do the writing and the art sometimes, I'm quite fluid with I don't always complete the script. Sometimes I'll kind of draw and try and get a feel for things, which sometimes makes it more difficult for myself, because it's almost like a bit of a chicken and egg scenario. Sometimes I'll just draw images, and because I draw digitally, then I can kind of crop them and move them, and then I'm like, okay, no, let's make that extreme close up, or okay, no, let's put it this way, you know. So sometimes I'll do exactly that. I'll draw key moments and play around with it, and then I'll kind of piece it together like a puzzle sometimes. So
it's actually pretty interesting. I wonder if, like, back in the day, drawing entirely, like, you know, by hand, you know, they still were able to, I'm pretty sure they said, like, photocopiers kind of thing, maybe not as great in depth, but the ability to, you know, enlarge an image pencil wise before it gets to the inkers. That just made me think about that. Like, if a penciler did a good job with this panel, maybe they actually were like, you know, we want to zoom in. So they'd zoom in and then ink it. Right. Cause it still had to be done manually, but I'm just curious. Cause I think with projectors, that's how they would do that. I don't think they had, trying to think about when they first started, if they really had photocopies. I don't know if they did.
Yeah. I was chatting to an artist. He worked for Marvel UK years ago, and he was saying they would do that, you know, blow it up and then trace over it. And I think that's where the thumbnail stage back then was more important as well, because, you know, then the writer could look over the thumbnail and say, to make this hit more, okay, let's change that panel, and then they'll do another thumbnail, and you know, and you could quite easily change and edit elements before you get to that stage where, you know, nowadays if you're working digitally, it's a lot easier to do that. And I think that's probably why I work digitally mostly, is just because you've got that
wiggle room.
Yeah. Which is kind of good. It's like a knife edge. It's like it's good and bad. I don't think I would have been able to make a comic if I couldn't do things digitally. I'd have to take too long, way too long.
For the non-initiated, what's the thumbnail phase? I'm asking, like, for the non-initiated, describe the thumbnail phase.
So that's basically where you're drawing an image on a piece of paper that's roughly, you know, they kind of like your thumb-sized images. So you're kind of shrinking down the sequential page, and you're not drawing in all the detail. You're maybe kind of drawing in the panels. So you could have one page with lots of different thumbnail images. And it's basically a quick sketch of each page to show the panel layout and maybe the camera angle and the subject in each panel. And so it'd be a very quick overview of what the page is, how the page is going to be laid out. And then often artists would then share that with the writer, maybe the editor, and you can then look at the image now and compare the script and say, okay, that's kind of, you know, it captures everything that I needed. And because if you've got them all on a page or quite a few on a page, you can now see the flow of the comic. And some artists might add in the contrast element. So some will add in where they think the blacks are. And again, you start to now get a better feel for the page. Some don't. It's not essential, but it's just that kind
of... Would they do that with like pencil, you mean? Like, so instead of inking it, they would just like maybe draw in a little darker in the pencil?
Sometimes they would come in with like a thick marker, like a Sharpie, and just kind of really roughly do it in. So you wouldn't have details on faces. Usually it's usually just face and a line for dimensions. And okay, that's kind of the action that character's doing. And the reason for doing that is because it's much easier to make the changes at the thumbnail stage than it would be later on. You know, if the artist now delves in and does all the fine detail, and then you pass it to the inker, and then you're like, okay, now we want to change this panel. Well, one, you've wasted all that effort, and it's probably you're going to start to annoy your penciler and your inker. But it just takes time, so it's far easier to do that at the thumbnail stage. Which people still do, even if it's digitally. A good example, Tommy Lee Edwards, artist who's done work with Jonathan Ross, who's a UK entertainer. He kind of got into comics. I think they did Turf together. Tommy Lee Edwards has done...
I see Galactus over here getting drawn.
Yes, he done 1985 with Mark Miller, which was a great Marvel comic. And he's done Mother Panic for DC. He's one of my favorite artists. And if you do, I think at the back of Turf, I think he's got like a process of how he does his thumbnails. And he'll even go as far to lay out speech bubbles. Because actually that's kind of missed... in all of the discussions we've had, even in contrast, you forget that this big white bubble is going to stand out as contrast, you know, and actually that should be taken into account because that also draws your eye in a certain way. So he tends to plan in his thumbnail stage where he thinks the speech bubbles are going to go.
Yeah, so, our artist, J.R. Harris, or Josh, whatever he wants to be called, he's doing our comic Mittens, and... he put the speech bubbles in the thumbnail. And then this is page one. And this is what page one looks like when it's not a thumbnail. So yeah, I was like, oh, wow, that looks different. So yeah, I actually liked when, because he was the first person to actually do that, to put like the actual speech bubbles in there. So I actually know where they're going to be.
Yeah. Yeah. It's useful from a planning point of view. And yeah, it's helping to see how things are going to flow.
I was gonna say that's definitely a big one for the artist to consider, because like I mentioned earlier, like I'll say like, oh, 2/3 size panel and this is how I want it to look, but I might not be registering where the text should be. And so that's something that the you know, I think a decent artist will be looking at that going, hey, you know, you got all this text and you want this panel to be this small. Like, I don't know where you want to fit that.
Now, there's another aspect to this, which kind of goes a layer deeper. And this touches on stuff that Scott McCloud writes about quite a bit. So, that kind of gives you a sense. It's what we've discussed is kind of like a basic sense of, okay, what should be driving me to lay out the page? And there's multiple factors. But the size of your panel, panels represent time in comics. And so often the shorter the panel, you're kind of implying that time is passing quicker than a panel that's bigger and open. And so there's a temporal aspect to laying out your panels. So if there's an action sequence and it's boom, 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 and you're kind of, you know, this is all happening really quickly, then you're choosing that's going to help you dictate how do I lay out my page. You're going to have smaller panels to kind of indicate that all these things are happening really quickly. And then when you contrast that with a big open panel, then time slows down and, you know, you give the reader a chance to have a look.
Like the splash pages, like, you know, when you have the big explosion on a splash page, obviously an explosion isn't like 1 second. It's typically, you know, exploding outward. So like, yeah, no, we definitely have done that a couple of times in our comics, like the quick little punches, and it's like 1, 2, 3 with panels. And then, yeah, like an explosion's a whole splash page. So you can see, like, you know, yeah, this is going to be a while.
Which is one of the things that amazes me about comics, because in that example that you just said, you've got an instant in a moment of time. Like you said, time's passing quickly, but because it's a splash page, the reader's going to dwell on it a bit longer, you know, because there's so much more to look at. And that's what amazes me about comics. You can take these, you can play with time in such an interesting way in terms of how time's depicted and then how much time the reader spends on that time depicted. That makes sense.
Yeah, well, like for example, if it was a fight scene and it's a back and forth, but then there's one final blow, that might be a much larger panel with a lot of detail on this like fist that's coming in to, you know, end the bad guy. It's definitely something that you're like, oh, this must be the final hit. Yeah, you flip the page and boom, you know, something happens.
Yeah, and so that's another side of things that you can bring in. I won't go too deep into it because it's something I'm still exploring and trying to understand. But I will recommend if people want to delve into that kind of temporal aspect, Scott McCloud's books, Understanding Comics and Making Comics, fantastic for that kind of stuff. He really delves into it. But again, all of that is information to help you decide how to lay out your panels. So
nice. I've been like saving all these books as you mentioned them.
Yeah, I've got a slide with them on. Hopefully that might be helpful at the end.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Okay, now the last subject, this is one I've recently been trying to explore myself, and I wrote a blog article on my website about it. And it was trying to play on a particular relationship that words and images have. So Scott McCloud breaks down panels into categories. So for example, you could have if someone was throwing a punch and then the speech bubble says, I'm throwing a punch, you've got the same information displayed by image and text. Now you might have the bulk of the information in the text and maybe the image enhances that, or vice versa, where maybe the bulk of the information is in the visuals and the text is enhancing that. But and there's a few other ones. The most interesting panel to me is what he called the interdependent panel. And this is where you would get different meanings from both the image and the text separately, but you only get the full picture when you combine them together. An interesting example would be a woman on the phone and she's crying and the speech bubble says, I'm fine. So, the speech bubble says, I'm so happy for you.
Oh yeah. Like happy cry as opposed to sad cry. Yeah.
If you just had the image, you think she's sad. And if you just had the speech bubble, you think, oh, she's happy for someone. You combine it together now you get a totally different meaning. You know,
yeah, she's so happy she's crying.
Yeah.
Or she's lying, yeah, depending on the context. Yeah.
Yeah, she could be lying on the phone, hiding her true feelings. And that second scenario, you now tell the reader almost like a implied secret, you know, that's not explicitly expressed. You know, you've kind of subconsciously deduced her emotional state based on the information that's given in the words and the text. And I think this is what kind of hooks the reader in. They're kind of subconsciously working out things that you're not explicitly telling them. That makes sense.
Yeah. I was just going to say with comics, I think the thing I love about it is like in a novel, you get to write so much to like translate that exact same thing. And for a film, you would need a series of things to happen. And with comics, if done properly, you can do it with a single image that has text on it. Yeah. That's why comics are like such an interesting medium.
Yeah. And so I was starting to think, okay, how do you create more of that? Because I think when your brain's kind of figuring stuff out in the background and you're deducing emotions or things that aren't known to the characters in the story, but as a reader, you're now discovering and figuring out these things. I think it draws you into the story. So I started to think, well, how can you do more of that? And like you said, in a film, you might rely on the actors to kind of convey the emotions that the characters are feeling, but not expressly saying, you know, they're not saying I feel sad or I feel angry. They're kind of acting it, and we're kind of picking up on these things. And I only realized this is called subtext. And I was like, oh, wow, I didn't know what subtext was because I hadn't, you know, I'm quite fresh to studying writing and all the tools of writing. And so subtext is the implicit meaning of the text. It's the underlying message that's not being explicitly stated or shown. So I started to think, how do you do that in comics? And two useful tools to both writers and artists, it's through body language and actions. And the one I'll focus on a bit more is facial expressions. So facial expressions are so hard, but you can convey so much through facial expressions. And it can be really difficult to depict certain emotions. But if you can, now you can start to convey certain things without implicitly saying it. If that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, like, that same scene where you're talking about someone crying, but saying, like, you know, I'm so happy. You know, you could actually alter whether or not she's lying or she's so happy she's crying by literally coloring it like red colors or blue colors.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, like warmer, cold colors. Like even that little bit of things, you know, could be that.
Yeah. And now you start to create subtext within your story. So some great examples for me, there was Will Eisner, whom the Eisner Awards are named after. He was great with body language, and if artists haven't come across his work, I highly recommend it. He was great with body language, you know, because he'd focus on the silhouette that a body creates, and a lot of his comics would be kind of wordless. Not all of them, but some of them, you'd have whole 2-page mini story. And this is an excerpt from one of them. I think this is all about New York or city life. And he was talking about downtown smells and uptown smells. Only one speech bubble on the whole of those 2 pages, but he'd create this story and you'd get the sense of emotion purely from the way he would draw the characters and the body language. His work's fantastic. Another great artist who used lots of black and contrast to kind of, you know, bring your eye in. He seemed to be a big fan of open panels. He did a lot of this kind of style where very few of the panels have like a hard edge.
It is very interesting because like I'm noticing like on the left page, the middle row of panels, basically It's very easy to flow left from right because in the first panel, he's at a certain height on the page as well. Very dark contrast. The very next one, he's in the background, a little smaller, but he's still the dark contrast. Then the whole panel's darker, and then he's still in contrast, but he's even closer than the first panel. And then the next one's like an action pose, like it just naturally draws you across.
Yeah. And he was a genius. I mean, I've got some of his books on sequential art and storytelling, which are great books. And he goes through some of, you know, how extreme body language helps to convey certain emotions.
Like the shaking knees.
yeah. And then he'd go into facial expressions as well. But on the facial expressions, I think facial expressions are the harder one. So I think in comics, I think a lot of artists focus on body language because it's very gestural and it's a bit easier to think of, okay, if I show someone scared and cowering, okay, I can draw them hunched over and small. Or if you draw someone strong and powerful, okay, I can draw that big frame and, you know, strong stance. But I think the harder thing to do is facial expressions.
Especially depending on the size of them.
Yeah. And I think sometimes as well, artists get into this habit, I know I do, of when you're drawing faces, you've got like the shorthand for a face. And maybe you look at some comics and you'll always find the main character has like mainly just one expression. You know, his eyes are always squinting and maybe kind of his expression just changes by the shape of his mouth, whether it's open and he's shouting or he's just grimacing or it's just a little bit of a smile. But, you know, sometimes we tend to default to kind of one face, if that makes sense. And an interesting exercise would be to take, if you take some comics and you only took the face out of the panel, would you be able to deduce how that character's feeling just based on the face alone? Sometimes you'll see that facial expressions aren't used as much as they can be. But this page is taken from Making Comics. And this is, to me, a slice of the genius that Scott McCloud put together. So
I was just going to say, one of the ones I love is like the fear and surprise one and how both eyes are pretty open, both brows are furrowed, but the eyebrows are pushed in or out, and then the mouth is either rounded or like rectangular.
Yeah. I use these pages like constantly because sometimes artists will use mirrors. You know, I don't know if you've heard that before. They'll kind of make the face of how they think the characters or sometimes nowadays you can just take a selfie and then you can draw from it. But he breaks it down into six basic emotions that we express: anger, disgust, fear, joy, sadness, and surprise. And if you have like a volume dial in each of those, you can create varying potentials of like that.
Levels, yeah.
Yeah, levels of that. So for example, anger, if you kind of start small, you've got sternness, then you go a bit further up, indignation, then anger, then rage. And he does that for each of those six emotions.
I just noticed too, I love that he picked the third one in all of them to be the main one, right? So like anger, disgust, fear, like that's what he defines as the main one. And then there's a softer version and then a very minor version, or there's the extreme version.
Yeah. And that already gives you a wide base of emotions to start playing with. Like that's what, 4 times 6, you know, you've got a huge amount of different facial expressions there. Now he takes it a step further and he starts to mix the variations.
Disgust and anger, outrage. Yeah.
Yeah. I think these are the six basic ones. You know, anger, you've got that kind of third level. But if you take the intensities and you start mixing the different intensities, like this one is
cruelty, anger, and joy. So I just love that one.
Yeah. But that's what that's kind of like part of the base part of those emotions, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and if you start to mix them, like this one's genius. Strong sadness plus moderate anger plus moderate joy equals remembering a deceased loved one. Now that's a really specific emotion.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, remembering a deceased loved one is part of all of those emotions, sadness, plus anger that they're gone, plus joy of memorizing, you know, remembering the
emotions. It's interesting too, because like what it looks like, if you look at the strong sadness, like there's a hyper furled brow, but then none of the other two, moderate anger or joy, have that. And then you look at the forehead of the combination and it's like a softened version. Like it's just like trying to blend. It's very, very cool.
Yeah. So and I really wish he did a few more pages like this where he started to mix them up, especially down to this level, because these are emotions that are now, it goes beyond those six basic ones of just anger, fear, you know, joy, rage. These are really specific, and I think that the adds a new layer to the story, you know, and you know, remembering a deceased loved one, that's a real emotional punch to the reader. You know, if you conveyed that and you're trying to convey the emotion that's going on with that character, or things like puzzlement or pity. I mean, he says you can go on and on and on with the variety, but I wish he did a few more pages on this, but I'm constantly, again, referring back to these pages to kind of, you know, again, he comes up, there's things on here that I'm like, pain, empathy, you know, a faint hope. It's just genius.
It's cool too. I was just doing math because I was just curious, like if you only had the six basic ones and you could combine up to three of them, you know, you already started with 120 different emotional expressions, and that's not including the variety of the four different levels of that emotion, putting that up to 480 different types of emotions you could have. Like it's a very, very cool thing.
Yeah. And I think maybe, I don't know if I'd call it a pet peeve, but I think this is what I'd like to see more of in the comics industry in general. I think, you know, when I think of kind of the emotions that I see, even in mainstream comics, you know, it's usually quite basic emotions. And I think
it's more like the Scott drawing of himself. It looks more like that.
Yeah. I think there's so much potential to kind of dial up the emotional investment of the reader through just through facial expressions. And, but it is harder. Like it's like, you know, I don't know how he came up with this, but yeah, this takes a lot of research and kind of trialing and thinking, okay, I want to portray this. What's going to be the base emotions that make up this emotion I'm trying to do? You know,
I just thought of something that would be very interesting. I'm actually going to probably end up getting this book now, just because, what I think would also help with this is that when a writer is writing something, I bet that they stick mostly to the six, the main six. I bet they very rarely use combinations of them, let alone the variations in degree. And having a almost like a matrix of these things, so that you could basically go, what are my three people in this panel feeling? And then just tagging them like that. I think that would be something tremendously helpful for a writer to be aware of, and an artist to be able to draw. Well, first off, an artist should know these things, and the writer should be aware of these things so that they can then provide that to the artist.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it prompts that thinking from the artist, like, oh, okay, yeah, I need to think from an emotional point of view. Or even if you highlight, okay, this particular scene, the key emotion I want the reader to come away with is puzzlement or pity or sadness, and then the artist can think about pulling these things in. Because when I want readers to read my comic, if there's a sad moment, I want them to feel really sad. A bit like when you watch a film, and you can feel yourself, you know, your heart's in your throat, and you're beginning to feel that emotion because it's been conveyed so clearly and accurately and believably on screen. And I'm like, well, I want that in my comics. And I think this is part of how we do it.
I'm looking to see. Oh, there's puzzlement. Yeah. Mild disgust and mild sadness. I think the other thing that he did really well too is understanding the breakdown of complex ones. So like, obviously we've heard the word outrage, but what is that really? It's not just massive anger. It's massive anger with a level of disgust, right? Like the fact that, like, puzzlement, I would not have thought disgust and sadness. Yeah. Right. I was trying to think, like, would puzzlement like almost have mild joy maybe, but no, it actually It's interesting. Yeah, like it's mild sadness and mild disgust. Like it's a very, very good breakdown.
He's a really interesting guy. I think he even did a TED talk on comics, and some of it was his journey in comics. Whoops, I'll save that to last. And he's done, he's written, I think for all the comics theory he's written, I think he's only really published, I think it's two stories. And one of them took him like a, I think it was like a decade to do. I think it was called the sculpture, one of the two. And it was like quite a thick comic. But you know, he's, yeah, I love his work. I think and those two books he's done, I think he's done three books: Understanding Comics, Making Comics, and it was like The Future of Comics. But those first two, Understanding Comics and Making Comics, have really stood the test of time.
Oh, Reinventing Comics, the Evolution of an Art Form. Yeah.
So just as an overview, so these are the books that I've kind of referred to. You've got Framed Ink 1 and 2. And he does a couple more on perspective, but in terms of storytelling, these are the ones I found most useful. The ones when we talked about contrast, that was from this book, The Best of Wizards Basic Training, How to Draw. Loads of seasoned artists in there, you know, Jim Lee, Adam Hughes. You've got loads of old school artists in there as well, back when, you know, from the Wizard days. And then, yeah, Making Comics by Scott McCloud. So hopefully that's, you know, there's something there useful to all creators out there, whether you're writing or drawing comics. And again, I think we've only really just scratched the surface. Like, you can, so much to go into, but this is the kind of stuff I love. And I try to write about it in my blog articles on my website, because those are the things I kind of like to explore. I'm kind of learning as I go along as well. I'm kind of like, hey, there's this really interesting thing in making comics, and some of it is just notes for myself almost, you know.
That was very cool. Nice. That was capped off right in an hour. That was pretty good. Nice. So, if people want to learn more about this, you just mentioned a blog. Where do you want to send them?
So I've got a website, sebastian-chow.com. Nice and simple. And there I do updates on projects I'm working on. I try to add articles, either on making art or making comics. So I think I put one up a little while ago on what digital tools are there if you're thinking of working digitally, because I recently had to change my setup. Can you create comic art on an Android tablet versus a Wacom tablet? I think I've had some articles on books, useful books, and book kind of mini book reviews. And just updates on Catapulted. I have got a store on there, but I've got no more physical copies of Catapulted. Digital ones available on there, and I'll soon be putting up. I'm starting to do a few pieces of traditional art, because I appreciate people like to purchase traditional art. It's a one-off, and I think you can appreciate that artistic skill when you see all the strokes up close. So I'm going to start selling sort of pieces of art on there soon as well.
Very cool. Nice. Well, thanks for hopping on, and definitely hope to chat with you more soon.
My pleasure. I love talking about this, and so you can't shut me up sometimes when I start. But yeah, I appreciate you guys having me on.
Nice. Thanks.